Thanks for joining us. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on a cruise with public radio listeners. As the long battle to overhaul the nation's health care system enters the home stretch, new life has emerged for a public insurance option. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are determining whether there are enough votes to include a public provision and trying to resolve other differences as they prepare compromise bills for unveiling this week. Joining me in the studio for an update on the progress of the legislation are Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News and Kerry Budoff Brown of Politico. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning. Kerry, where does the health care legislation stand in terms of the timelines that were originally set by the president and by Congress?
Well, Congress has managed to blow through multiple deadlines. Where we're at this point now, I think months ago, the hope was that, of course, bills would have been passed out of both the House and Senate by August. We're still waiting for that action. And that could happen in the House before Thanksgiving. Today, on the Senate side, though, today the Senate Majority Leader is expected to send several versions of a bill to CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which will give it a cost and estimate and present options to his Democratic caucus tomorrow. So I think this week, at least, we could see a bill unveiled. We're supposed to see a bill unveiled in the Senate that will then move to the floor within a week or two. So that doesn't leave actually much time for them to get their debate on the floor done before Thanksgiving. People expect it to last 3, 4, maybe more weeks. That brings you well past Thanksgiving, and you're really hitting tightly up against that Christmas deadline that was sort of the last-ditch deadline that the White House and members of Congress wanted, Democratic members of Congress. I say they'd be pushing it at this point.
And when is the CBO supposed to come back with its estimate?
It should take a few days. It could take longer. I don't have a very good sense. It depends on how much they're changing the bill, but they do have to do a bit of analysis to see what interacting parts change what. But it may take them less time than it has in the past, given that they've already scored a lot of this through the last few months.
Right. Mary Agnes, what are the next steps then in terms of actually crafting the legislation?
Well, once the if in fact, as Kerry's talking about, if the Senate can produce a bill and bring it to the House, bring it to the Senate floor rather, they'll have to have their debate. Same thing will have to happen in the House. And the hope is, among proponents of the legislation, that the House will pass a bill, the Senate will pass a bill, then you have to have a House-Senate conference. But you can already see movement among Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, to try to get these bills in sync. The public option is one of those. Do you have a provision that allows states to opt out? Do you negotiate rates with your providers versus tying them to Medicare? How do you work that? That's a key difference right now between the pending House bills and the bill the Senate Finance Committee passed and a bill the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee passed. So we have to go to a conference report, and then the conference report would go back to both floors to be passed, and then it would go to the president's desk.
Kerry, what is a public option? Explain to us, because I know there are different versions out there.
Sure. It's the easiest way to look at it. A lot of people know what Medicare is. It's a government program of that kind, potentially. That's the model, but for people under 65 years old. However, The differences come in that the way, well, at least the debate and why it's hung up in Congress is just how, with it being a government plan, how do you pay doctors and hospitals? If you pay Medicare rates, it's a very low rate that puts the government at an advantage over private insurers, which is why private insurers are not in favor of this, because they feel like they would not be able to compete with the government. So in the Senate, you're seeing various options being discussed, the idea of putting the government plan on a level playing field with private insurers. That would save the government less money because they wouldn't be able to, they'd have to pay higher rates. But I think the bottom line, just for the average person out there wondering what this means, it really actually may not mean much to a lot of people in this country, because it is just going to be one option and as part of a broader exchange, an insurance market exchange that actually If you have employer-provided coverage now, you won't be able to use the exchange, which means you won't have access to the public option. So we talk – the public option has become an outsized influence in this debate when, in fact, it's only going to affect – I think only 10 or 12 million people will be able to get into it or something like that. So it's a very small amount of people. And I actually think – when people – I've talked to a lot of members of Congress, senators, particularly Ron Wyden of Oregon, who has proposed just a much more drastic system whereby people would have more choice in the system, just take their employer-provided coverage and go out – get the tax credit and go out and buy their own coverage. Senators like him say people who don't really recognize this are going to be disappointed when they realize that they're not going to have access to this public option that a lot of people that we're all talking about so much.
Right. Well, Mary Agnes, it's amazing because if it only, in fact, involves potentially 10 or 12 million people, it's been a great fuss and a great sturm and drang over a relatively limited program. But what brought it back to life? In August, it seemed to be dead.
In August, it seemed to be dead. In late September, when the Senate Finance Committee voted on it, it was defeated. It seemed to be dead. I think there was a very strong grassroots pushback by progressives that wanted this part of the debate. Liberals in Congress wanted to keep this part of the debate. And the idea of choice, Carrie's got a great point. You're talking about 12 million people who had an option for this. There are firewalls to stop people to get into the exchange because the drafters of the bill don't want to undermine the employer-based system. But it's the message of choice that Democrats have really wanted to make clear to people, that you would have a choice of health insurance and also be able to keep the insurance you have. I think that message of choice has really driven this debate.
So do you now feel, both of you, that some sort of public option is very likely?
I think it's extremely likely to be, and whether it is the trigger, which is something else, or whether it's an opt-out for states, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think more so, like what also happened in the last month is that when the debate shifted from one in which Democrats were trying to get Republicans, such as Chuck Grassley, who was a conservative, when you lost Chuck Grassley, it became just a debate mostly entirely within the Democratic Party, plus Olympia Snowe, who in many ways is, you know, a moderate who does not want a government plan, but she's proposed a variation of a public plan. So the debate became less heated, and you saw senators come up with other options. So you didn't have just the public plan or no public plan or the public plan and a co-op, which a lot of progressives didn't like, but you had these various options, and Democratic leaders felt like they had enough leeway to negotiate within their entire caucus and get some variation of that in the bill. The question is how strong it is, which is something that, you know, we don't know yet, and is going to be a, you know, pretty big debate in terms of how just to structure whatever public option you have.
And of course, it's generated a whole new category of jargon.
Yes.
There's a robust option. There's a trigger option. There's an opt-out option. Mm-hmm. How much do they matter? How much are they different, Mary Agnes?
Well, the robust option would be linked to what Medicare pays health insurance providers. And as Carrie noted earlier, that's viewed by many in the provider community as less than what they need, and it would create a cost shift onto the private sector. And then you could also have a negotiated rate, which would be sitting down with the doctors and hospitals and so on and negotiating that rate. The opt-out idea would be a state could opt out of this. You would instigate the public option.
Right.
A state could opt out. They don't want to do it. And the trigger is the idea that if the public option would not go into place until the affordability issue. If you had affordable insurance available to 95% of the state residents, you wouldn't have a public option triggered. But if that affordability threshold were not met, then you would trigger the public option for that state.
And the notion, Carrie Boudouf Brown, has been that this is going to drive down costs.
That is the argument among proponents. That
it hold up?
There's a lot of difference of opinion on that. I think the academics who thought of this idea only, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I mean, this wasn't part of the debate back when Al Gore was running in 2000. It wasn't vote, we need a public plan. It was, a different kind of debate. I mean, the idea is to create a competitor for private insurance. But if you limit it's the ability of this plan to negotiate rates or to set rates, it will not provide as robust a competitor like Mary Agnes says, in terms of it being a robust system that's based on Medicare. It's really going to force insurers to lower their prices. But again, it's going to be a small competitor when you think about the entire market. The idea is that I think what people fear about this is that it will get a foothold and it'll slowly drive out private insurers, or it'll slowly force more insurers to be competitive, or, you know, just whichever way you look at it. I just think there is a lot of difference of opinion right now on how big of a player it can be in the market, given how limited it'll be.
Mm-hmm. Mary Agnes, how much did the public opinion polls affect this resurrection of the idea?
Well, I think it's something they've certainly been watching. Again, we talked about earlier in August, people seemed very concerned about the public plan. It would be a government takeover of the health insurance system. I think as the debate has continued and people have watched it, and the poll numbers in the last week or two have begun to show more strength behind the public plan option, I think that's definitely a factor.
I think I agree. I would feel like whenever a major poll would come out, I felt like you could feel the shift in the Capitol, like among senators who actually really wanted to see these poll numbers improve, but it would not go unnoticed. And you would start seeing more senators tout the polls as soon as they came out. So I feel like the polls are pretty important, even though there's a lot of disagreement as to how much they really mean, given the kind of questions that are asked. But I think they've had a big influence.
And generally speaking, liberals have been more enthusiastic about this.
Yes.
Conservatives less, moderate somewhere in the middle?
Yes, that is the breakdown. I mean, you almost have the entire Republican Party, with the exception of Olympia Snow, saying they don't like it. And even Olympia Snow says it would be difficult for her to support a bill with a government plan at the outset, or a government plan in general. Her trigger option is a national nonprofit kind of plan separated from the government or quasi-government kind of entity. And then, yeah, you have moderates like Ben Nelson, who's extraordinarily important right now, who is not very excited about a government plan. He prefers something called an opt-in, which is that's a fifth option, which is states would be able to create their own public option or co-ops or something like that. But it leaves the decision up to the state. So it's a real struggle. I mean, that's why it's gotten so much attention, because it fits so easily into kind of like our partisan warfare that we have here in Washington.
Okay. It's a huge debate. Coming up, more about the public option. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm, who's off on a cruise with public radio listeners. I'm joined here in the studio by Mary Agnes Carey, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She recently served as associate editor for CQ's Health Beat, a daily report on healthcare policy, and by Carrie Budoff Brown, who's the healthcare reporter for Politico. Isn't it interesting? We don't have to explain what Politico is anymore.
That is interesting. Carrie.
Not so before that. All right. Count votes for me, if you will. Carrie, are they there in the Senate, in the House?
As of last night, they weren't, or they weren't saying that they were in either House. In the House, based on the idea of getting the most, you know, strongest public option, I think they're still looking for votes. This leadership spent the weekend talking to members. Same in the Senate with Harry Reid. He spent the weekend talking to members. As of yesterday morning, Senator Chuck Schumer was saying they're very close. I think the person who's a holdout was also on another show yesterday morning, Ben Nelson, saying he was very excited about these options that Harry Reid was pursuing. I think we're all going to be looking for Ben Nelson today to see where he's going. And I know Harry Reid was talking with senators to see what they actually could support to get into, you know, put into the bill to get their support. So this is a big chess game right now.
Okay. Joining us now from Great Falls, Virginia, is Dr. Greg Bentz, who's the chief medical officer at a community hospital and was formerly a family physician in private practice. Dr. Bentz, are you with us?
I am, sir. Good morning, Terrence.
Good morning. A pleasure to have you. From your perspective, what's the most important thing in this whole debate that a community hospital needs, from this overhaul proposition?
Sure. Well, when patients come to a hospital in general, I think they're basically saying three things. Please take care of me. Please don't hurt me. And if it's not too much trouble, if you would be nice to me, that would be great. Our mission here, of course, is to treat people, to treat patients. One of the overriding questions is, well, how do you keep a hospital running? I mean, I'm sure you're all aware, because your other two guests sound very knowledgeable, that many hospitals have not survived some of the financial exigencies of healthcare at this point. What happens then if the emergency department becomes the safety net and they continue to do their job? It would sure help from our perspective if costs were kept down. We're on a very razor thin margin. I'm in a not for profit hospital, and those are our concerns.
And the idea of a public option, what's your view of that, and how would that affect you?
Well, I think the key word there is the second word, that it's an option. I think one of the things that we've found in America in general is that most people like having having options. It's to some extent a good news, bad news kind of thing. The good news is the 44 or 47 million people that weren't previously covered are now covered. Having coverage for all Americans, I think, is an excellent thing. The bad news is, and I've just by listening to your two guests today, I found that with these firewalls in place, I think most doctors would fear that it would become not just an option, but the only option.
All right, Mary Agnes, have you heard that concern expressed before?
I have, and there's the fear that the, for example, if in the public option you tied the reimbursements to Medicare rates, it would lower the cost of that policy. More people would go to that policy, pushing private insurers out of the market over time. This is a concern of conservatives, and the public option would grow in importance and not simply be a choice, but be, in the words of those who oppose it, an unfair competitor.
All right, let's ask Dr. Bentz if that seems like a realistic concern to him.
Well, I think, as I understand it, I think I would reiterate, patients and Americans in general like choice. If in fact, and I was very intrigued by the notion that this would only affect 10 to 12 million people. I know that when Medicare came about, the medical establishment had great misgivings about that. And now, my word, I mean, we've taken care of the greatest generation, and I think most people would say that was a wonderful thing. If this healthcare overhaul were to turn out as well as that, I think most people would say that's a win.
So you sound open to it.
I'm getting on, and yeah, I'm very open to options. Yes, sir.
All right, and Carrie, that 10 to 12 million. I mean, still a real number. I suppose that could grow if some of these other possibilities came to play.
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly what Mary said. You could, I mean, I think we're all kind of guessing as to what the consumer behavior will be under this reform system. I think if the program works well, if it's not the worst case scenario that some people are laying out in terms of care, you won't be able to get access to doctors. It's good price. I think there seems to be, this recognition that, people are going to want to go with their wallets if they get equal care to their private insurers. Mm-hmm. So I can see a lot of people going towards it. I think the idea that there'll be an opt-out, states could opt out of a public option, that will be a political decision based on the climate in that state. And Mary and I were talking about this before the show. We don't kind of know how the political dynamics of each state would play out. A lot of red states have a large number of uninsured. Those pressures of, maybe limited government of those governors will be, come up against maybe some of their, voters who want that that cheaper option.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Bentz, I know that you were previously a family physician in private practice. Now you're at a community hospital. You say a not-for-profit hospital. What caused that change in your career? Was it the economics of all of this?
Not entirely. Certainly, reimbursements had declined over the years that I was in practice, but I had also acquired a certain amount of gray hair and hopefully respectability, and had an opportunity to work with and for a great chief executive officer of a hospital with more than 27 years in healthcare experience, and it was just too good to pass up. But I think more importantly, it shows and represents how hospitals have changed to focus on quality and safety. Those are the things I focus on here, to have improved relations between hospital administrations and medical staffs. Those, in order to have things to meet these mandates for quality and safety, those two entities have to work together, and that's a big part of my day.
All right. Let's go to some of the callers that we've already have on the line. Who have questions for us as well. Elizabeth in northeastern Massachusetts, are you on the line?
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. What's your question?
Well, when it's clear that a majority of the citizens wants a public option, and you admit, your guests even admit, that people who don't qualify would be disappointed, why are we bending over backwards to accommodate insurance providers, Republicans and Blue Dogs, and why not let them filibuster and show their true colors?
Well, I guess vote count is part of the answer, but Carrie?
I think there's a lot of caution that still permeates this whole debate. There's still a lot of fear from, or at least amongst politicians or the White House and leaders of Congress, that if you overreach or you become too ambitious, that you are going to just potentially lose it all. And that's so potentially damaging to Democrats, the idea of getting this far and not being able to deliver. So I think there's caution, that the White House is still cautious about even putting a national plan in the bill that's going to come out this week and allow states to opt out. I mean, that's just not where I think the political prognosticators thought this debate would be. It seems like it's beyond where the Senate is able to go ultimately.
So cautious about representing the majority of the American public, as opposed to the insurance providers.
Yeah, I mean that is exactly what folks outside Washington can't really understand. That whole idea of the.
You're right. We can't.
Yeah. No.
We can't understand it, and I'd really like to hear it explained in terms that make sense to me, other than that our representatives are in the pockets of the lobbyists.
Okay, Mary Agnes, do you want to comment on that?
Overhauling the health insurance system that we have in America is incredibly complicated. Your views and the views of those who agree with you are incredibly important to lawmakers. But to Carrie's point, you're talking about a sixth of the economy, for example. That's a big factor. You're talking about all the people, 170 million or so, that get health insurance right now from the employer-based system. They don't want to disturb that. You've got conservative senators, some moderates of the Democratic Party. Ben Nelson was mentioned before, very concerned about upending how a lot of people get their health insurance. I don't know if you'll take comfort in this, but I think the fact that the public plan is where it is now in the debate mm-hmm. is due to voters like you making their concerns known, because as we noted at the top of this program, a few weeks ago, it was viewed as dead. So take heart. I would say keep calling your lawmakers and talking with them, but realize many of the complexities of this debate, and they're trying to navigate them to the best of their ability.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you for your call. Dr. Bentz, does that sound the frustration that you could hear in Elizabeth's voice? Does that sound familiar to you?
Oh, absolutely, sir. And heard it for many years. But I would also submit that Mary Agnes is right on the money. I mean, it's a very we didn't get into this situation overnight, and the healthcare system is very complex. And my hat is off to the person or persons that can improve on it.
All right, let's take another call, James in Largo, Florida. You have a question as well.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
You know, we talk about a number of 10 to 12 million, and that's a number that's set by Congress, is it not? Is it not, you know, couldn't they define it as 20 million or 30 million, depending upon the criteria?
Mary Agnes?
That figure comes from a score from the Congressional Budget Office that looks at the way the Senate finance bill is currently drafted, and they determine as the bill is written, that's where that number comes from. To your point, you're right. If they wanted to widen the pool of people who could get involved or change the parameters of the public health insurance plan, it could certainly grow over time. But again, because they don't want to disrupt the employer-based system, they have put in curbs to who can be in the exchange. We're talking mostly about individuals uninsured, small businesses, a few other groups that right now the enrollment would be limited, but they could certainly broaden that or make it even more narrow over time.
Right, but that's a projection.
Absolutely, it's a projection by the Congressional Budget Office. That's right. It's a guess. It's an estimate.
Right, not a project. No. Thank you, James. Carrie, any view on that?
No, I agree with Mary that it's just all how – I mean, your caller's right in that. It is how Congress sets it, and if Congress wants to go broader and bigger, they can. But the actual number is based on, you know, nonpartisan economists in the Congressional Budget Office that try to project things as best they can.
Okay. Let's take one more call here. Jeff in Empire – Michigan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Jeff, we'd like your question.
Yeah, I'm asking more of a specific question about my coverage. I've had colon cancer and I have Crohn's disease. Nobody wants to insure me. I wouldn't see why any of these co-ops are going to want to insure me. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a government plan that is going to sell insurance that I can afford. Right now, there's nothing out there I can afford.
All right, Carrie.
Well, in your case, this big part of this whole reform is the idea that insurers will no longer be able to deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions. So you would be able to receive coverage in the future. But and right now, actually, Congress is trying to, as part of this reform, they would immediately kick into effect this $5 billion fund where people who have pre-existing conditions or are unable to get insurance for 6 months would immediately be able to get coverage as part of a high-risk pool. So there's actually something more immediate benefit for you there if this is passed this year.
All right. Thank you. I'm Terrence Smith. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. We're talking about the great healthcare debate. Dr. Bentz, that caller's situation is probably one you've heard before.
It is. It is, and I'm sorry for Jeff. Those are issues we see on a regular basis, and I think once again I can't remember if it was Carrie or Mary Agnes that said it. That yes, it's my understanding as well that pre-existing conditions and failing to cover them goes out the window here. But it brings up again that as you all said, affordability. We have to have affordable health insurance and to manage health care costs in general. And so I hope for Jeff's sake all of that happens.
Has there been, can you discern, either of you, Mary Agnes or Carrie, a backlash against the insurance industry that has played a role in this debate?
Very much so. I mean, I think that, that insurers are viewed as the problem of the system, that they have not talked about the last caller talking about, nobody wants to insure me, where do I go? There's been concern about some of their practices in covering or not covering, their profit margins, their high administrative operating costs, and that basically that they are a part of the problem, and for some people that this is their comeuppance in this bill, whether it is the reduction in the Medicare Advantage, these are the private insurers in the Medicare market, reducing those costs, the Senate, or reducing their reimbursements, rather. Both bills would do that. The Senate Finance Committee would put an excise tax on some of the higher cost insurance plans. They would put a tax on the industry. I think that the tide has very much turned against them politically.
And yet, Carrie, they remain very active lobbyists in this whole debate.
Yeah, a little bit less welcome on Capitol Hill in the last 2 weeks since they you saw a succession of reports from the insurance companies in the last, I guess 2-3 weeks that have been roundly criticized by Democrats, even though the issues that they raise, I think, are going to become more prominent in the debate, that being how much will this reform really reduce premiums for everybody? The Democrats did not like what they did by releasing these reports right at the cusp of the Senate Finance Committee passing a bill. Senate finance aides have made clear that that was not welcomed. And, you know, the relations are frosty, especially with the White House, too. And I think you saw Democrats reacting. Some of the public option, it being alive again, is in part because of what the industry did in the last few weeks.
All right. Coming up, your calls and questions for our panel. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The best-selling authors of Freakonomics return to challenge assumptions about how we make decisions, whether incentives work, and what's really good for the world. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm, who's on her way to Egypt for a cruise on the Nile with public radio listeners. We're talking about the healthcare debate that is preoccupying Congress and Washington and much of the country. And I'm joined by two guests, Mary Agnes Carey, who is senior correspondent with the Kaiser Health News, and Kerry Budoff-Brown, who is the healthcare reporter for Politico. And joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, Dr. Arthur Garson. He's executive vice president and provost of the University of Virginia, and he chairs the American College of Cardiology's Health Reform Working Group. He's a practicing pediatric cardiologist with a long interest in the uninsured. Dr. Garson, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. We are pleased to have you. Give us your reaction to where this whole debate stands at this point.
I think there are a number of places that, as Mary Agnes and I have talked about several times, that may be a little distracting. And it's hard to imagine that the public plan is distracting, but it does seem to me that we're the public option. That I remember at a panel that Mary Agnes had us all at several weeks ago, she said, what must be in a bill and what must not? And I said, what must not is something that stands in the way of 50 million people getting health insurance. And so what I hope we don't see is that the public option becomes the sort of torch that everybody decides they've got to negotiate on and becomes the way that the entire thing goes down in flames. I hope that does not happen.
So you would argue that coverage, and particularly covering the uninsured, is what, the most important part of this whole issue?
I would argue that coverage, if we don't cover the uninsured in a meaningful way, we've failed. It's not the only thing. I think we've got to figure out how to pay for it. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to figure out how to make quality better and better while we are bending the cost curve. But if we don't figure out how to cover, if we don't figure out how to cover the 50 million, which is probably what it is by now, if we don't figure out how to do that in a meaningful way, we've failed.
Well, you talked about cost. Are physicians part of that problem?
Physicians are absolutely part of that problem. Let me refer all of us to the really sort of landmark article by Atul Gawande several months ago in The New Yorker, where, in fact, he went to McAllen, Texas, which was the second most expensive place in the country to practice medicine. Mm-hmm. And as he interviewed both doctors and hospitals, it became really clear that the way in which the physicians practiced medicine, the way in which they referred back and forth to each other, the way in which there was not a lot of understanding of what national practice guidelines are, really was the stark example of that physicians, unfortunately, practice with a perhaps four times practice variation across the country, meaning the rate of coronary bypass surgery in one part of the country is four times the rate in another part of the country with the same results.
Well, Dr. Garson, there's been a great deal of coverage of late about physicians ordering more tests than are necessary, expensive tests that contribute to the cost. Is that part of the problem? And if so, are they doing it, to protect against malpractice or what's going on?
Well, whether it's tests or whether it's doing unnecessary procedures,
right,
the motivation is complicated. And everything you mentioned, hopefully ending or at least starting, hopefully at the start, with they think they're trying to do the right thing. I mean, let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
But contributing to that is finance, is making money. Contributing to that is malpractice. You know, hopefully, and I really do believe this as a practicing doc, people are trying to do the right thing. But then when you then sort of say, all right, I'm doing the right thing, but I have a machine in my office that I have to do a certain number of these tests per day in order to pay for it. Does that enter into the equation at all? Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Any idea or any estimate of the total cost of that sort of thing, of overuse of tests and procedures?
There are estimates of 3 to 10%, but let me tell you what the problem with that is, and that is you have to ask doctors about their motivation. There's no other way of telling. So you can't just look at a chart and say that doctor was practicing because they wanted to avoid getting sued. You have to ask them. And there are studies out there that, you know, you'll get very different answers if you ask doctors at several different times. And again, like everything else, depending upon how you ask the question. So you cannot just say, okay, I understand that this doctor did that test because they were worried about getting sued without asking them.
Right.
Therefore, it's a very hard number to come by.
Okay. Dr. Garson, stick with us here. We're going to take a couple of calls. Aaron in Syracuse, New York, you've been very patient. Are you still with us?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Aaron Ben-Ezra. I'm an insurance agent in Central New York. I specialize in the Medicare insurances.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make 7 very quick comments in 1 minute.
Well, 7 sounds like too many, but tell me your most important point.
Well, the first thing is, you know, there's a housing crisis in the country, and many times housing crises are caused by problems paying mortgages after medical emergencies. Okay? The Medicare Advantage plans have an out-of-pocket limit that can help people to keep their homes in their bank accounts, and that is not available through traditional Medicare. Secondly, when it comes to freedom of speech, the reason a lot of people may not even know that is that agents, even if you're on you're not on the do not call list, agents are not allowed to cold turkey call someone and hang out their shingle and say, hi, I'm an agent. This is my specialty. Did you know? The third important thing, and this relates to the man who has colon cancer who called earlier,
mm-hmm.
There's a 2-year waiting period for disabled people before they're eligible for Medicare. So even though there's no waiting period for a pre-existing condition once you turn 65, you got a 2-year waiting period now. That man should be able to not have a waiting period.
All right. Let's ask Dr. Garson to comment on these points that you've made so far. Doctor?
Yeah, I'm here. I would love it if, no offense, if you could ask one question that you think I can help with, because everything you said I don't necessarily disagree with, but is there a question that I can answer?
Well, there was a comment earlier in the show, and the tenor of the show seems to be anti-insurance industry. And I'd like to suggest that it's not that simple. You know, in essence, Medicare is simply a large HMO.
Well, let me interrupt here for a minute, Aaron, because the tenor is not against the insurance industry. After all, that's at the heart of what we're talking about here. And everybody knows that it's going to continue and play the central role in healthcare in America going forward. So, Mary Agnes, I mean, that's not the thrust from you.
No, not at all. And we should also note that health insurers very early on in the debate came out front and said, we will cover uninsured Americans, we'll cover people with pre-existing conditions if you have a very strong individual mandate, a requirement that people get health insurance. In the eyes of some in the Senate Finance Committee, they made some changes to the bill that many observers feel will weaken the individual mandate. The insurance industry is concerned about that, and I think with good reason, because, you know, without a tough mandate, you may not get everybody in the health insurance system, and that means all those good, healthy risks won't be there, and that could increase prices for everyone. And let's not forget all the precautions, if you will, that lawmakers are taking not to undermine the employer-based health insurance system where so many people get their health insurance.
Carrie Budoff-Brown?
Yeah, I mean, I think that our discussion on the insurance industry is actually reflecting the debate on Capitol Hill, where Democrats are in charge and they are actively pursuing and going after the insurance industry. That has been the debate the last two or three weeks. The White House has made a villain of them. Democrats have gone down that road as well, fair or not. But that is the tenor of the discussion on Capitol Hill in terms of the insurance industry no longer really being at the table in Washington, D.C., even though, you know, as late as last week, Karen Ignani, the head of the America's Health Insurance Plans, is continually repeating, health insurers want health care reform. We support it.
Okay.
That's what's going on.
All right. Dr. Garson, I interrupted you. You wanted to say something.
Yeah. No, I think Mary Agnes makes a really important point that we need to pay attention to over the next month, and that is that when you say individual mandate, it means a very different thing to very different people. If it's $750, it's not an individual mandate. And so I think that when people say, oh, well, there's an individual mandate, or 94% are insured, those numbers are, in fact, you'd say, well, my goodness, that's okay. No, it's not. And I think that the insurance industry, for all that they, I would agree, made some gaffes over the last several weeks and should not have done what they did. The point remains that a strong individual mandate is important, because if you don't have one, people will ignore it. There's plenty of data in that in a lot of states, so it needs to be a strong individual mandate. And this, oh, well, we've got 94% insured. If you leave 20 million people in the United States uninsured, you've not changed the system. And that's what 94% does. So 94% isn't enough. The insurance companies in that case are right. I wish they had not gone about it the way they did, but those two numbers are important.
Interesting point. All right, Dr. Garson, thank you very much for joining us. I know that you broke away from a meeting that you were chairing, and we appreciate your time.
Good to talk.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's try to get another call or two in here. Amy in Indianapolis, Indiana, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that besides everyone getting insurance, that needs to be affordable insurance. My mother, who had cancer three times in a row, her insurance cost over $800 a month, and my father passed away, and she couldn't afford it anymore. She stopped her insurance. A year later, she found a golf ball-sized tumor in her breast and ended up with breast cancer. Had she had insurance, she would have found it sooner and wouldn't have passed away, because breast cancer, as we all know, early detection is, you know, a 90-some-odd percent cure rate. So because my mother did not have insurance, she passed. And it's just, it's not an acceptable situation in the United States.
I think many people agree with that, Amy. I'm Terrence Smith. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Mary Agnes, that's the very human side of this story.
Those stories, I think, drive this debate is so complex and it's difficult. The affordability issue she talked about is incredibly important, because how can you mandate someone has health insurance unless they can't afford it? There are provisions in the bill, some subsidies. There's going to be an expansion of the Medicaid program. At least it's called for in both bills. But I think this very, very powerful human interest story is what drives so many people that want to pass this bill now. This is inexcusable in the United States of America that someone would stop their health insurance and die because of it. But it happens every day.
Carrie?
Yeah, and I think her point on affordability, though, is it's a big frustration, I think, to progressives, more liberal, even, you know, just moderate Democrats who say all of this focus on the public option is not where the debate should be. It should be on making the coverage more affordable to everybody. And there's still a lot of questions about how affordable the coverage will be. Even if you get a subsidy, how much of your income you'll still be paying. It could be as high as 13%, 19% of your income you're paying in premiums. And Olympia Snow, that's one of her top issues, is changing this bill to make the coverage more affordable. because if you don't get the public, it just goes beyond, so far beyond the public option question, is whether actually we'll be giving away subsidies, but will they actually be able to afford average, you know, the middle to, like, I guess, lower to upper lower middle income folks, you know, who make up to $66,000, $80,000 for a family of four, will they actually be able to afford the coverage that they're now going to be able to get? It's, you know, a lot of people wonder whether that's going to happen.
Well, and that, Mary Agnes, that affordability issue was at the heart of the debates that took place even in the campaign last year.
Right. I mean, this is just a critical issue because, as we all know, health insurance rises in cost faster than the general rate of inflation. And we talked about it's critical to get everybody into the system to help lower the cost. But to Carrie's point, you know, if you start looking at what will the premiums be, what will the copays be, what will the deductibles be, and can you require somebody to cover to have something they can't afford, this is a critical issue because the subsidies that they're in the bill are one of the biggest financial parts of the bill. It's hundreds of billions of dollars. But this is something they're wrestling with, especially in the Senate, to get Olympia Snow's vote.
Okay. Well, it's a huge debate, a huge issue, a huge part of the economy. It's not going away, and I know that we'll be back to it. But I want to thank both of you, Mary Agnes Carey, the senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, and Carrie Budoff-Brown, healthcare reporter for Politico, for shedding some light on it today. So thank you both very much. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.